Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. Today, we are tackling some of those tough and perennial questions about faith, science, and the world around us. And joining me today is Dr. Miriam Schilling, a virologist studying theology who dives into the intersection of science and faith. In her work, Miriam explores some of the profound questions about the nature of viruses and the potential connections that we can draw between God, good, evil, and our natural world. This episode is slightly different from normal in that it's an open Q&A where our live audience at Holy Trinity Church Aylesbury had the chance to ask some of their own questions. We'll be wrestling some big topics such as, can science explain healings and miracles? Do humans have souls? And if so, will clones have souls as well? Is God truly good? And how can we know this? And is there ever a time when viruses can be seen as good? This episode was recorded earlier this year at a live event in partnership with Aylesbury Vale Youth for Christ. And kicking us off was the question, why did God create mosquitoes, poisonous snakes, and wasps that cause suffering? I know you have a real soft spot for mosquitoes, but I do a lot of work with young people and they often will ask, why did God create wasps or poisonous snakes or mosquitoes? So how would you respond to that?
Yes, so to be fair, when I wrote a book about viruses and why they're not evil but really interesting, I started my introduction saying, I understand where people are coming from because, you know, we all don't like mosquitoes and they're annoying. And so you probably feel about viruses like I feel about mosquitoes. Well, moving forward 3 years' time, I've worked with mosquitoes for the last project I worked on for a while.
And she names her mosquitoes just as a little...
Just the one. Her name is Helga, and she came from Greenland, and I love her. But actually, my friends named her because I was so excited about this beautiful picture I've taken under a microscope with that mosquito that they just named her Helga, and she even signed my birthday card. It's great. So I think they just really grew on me, and I think it's a combination. Of course, there's something beautiful about just the shimmering wings, and when you look at them in more detail, they're really pretty, and in contrast to ticks, and give me another 5 years' time, and probably at some point I'll find a tick that I really like, but at the moment, mosquitoes, yes, ticks, no, which is hilarious. So there's something aesthetic about them. I also think they're really interesting because, yes, they're annoying when they bite you, because it itches. Let's face it, no one likes that. But because they are moving around, of course, they're spreading pollen around just by accident because they're moving across plants, they're contributing there. And I'm pretty sure, and entomologists might hate me for that because I can't prove that, nor do we have any evidence. But because they have different viruses that they carry around, and when I claim that viruses are important for ecosystems, yes, of course, they're also moving around viruses that are important for ecosystems. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty sure they have some important functions that I wouldn't want to disrupt. So it's a combination of beauty and knowing that we don't understand them yet either. So I think there's probably fun stuff to discover. And if I ever have time, that's the next thing I'll do.
Look into mosquitoes. That could be your next PhD.
Yes. Specifically on mosquitoes. I mean, at the moment, I'm trying to discover viruses in mosquitoes. That's how Helga came into my team. So we'll see about those mosquito viruses.
Brilliant. Has anyone got a question? What I'll do is I'll get you to shout it out and then I'll repeat it on the microphone if that's okay. Go for it. That is an excellent question. So about healing, how would a virologist explain the phenomenon of someone having, let's say, a virus being
miraculously, whatever you want to, however you want to describe that, healed of that. How would you respond to that as a virologist?
I think that's really interesting because that reaches the limit of science. So in science, we measure things that are repeatable. A one-off that we would declare as a miracle, science can't explain. But that also doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So I think from a virology point of view, yes, we see lots of viruses being cleared because our immune system suddenly kicks in and manages that. And I think that we see repeated and repeated. But there are probably certain rare incidences where, you know, it's highly unlikely. But I think with viruses, we always have a good chance with our immune system. I think I would be interested if there were cases like HIV, which integrates into the genome. But being able to prove that it really has entirely cleared the whole body, that would mean we would have to sequence every individual cell of that individual, and we can't prove that either. So I think we would basically reach our limits as scientists and go like, we can't prove it. We can see this disease has gone, we don't know why. So I think, yeah, this is where science has reached their limit because we can't look at miracles. Our immune systems are so different. And for example, when you compare a bat population and a human population, because the bats have a very different immune system, there's lots of viruses around, but they don't cause disease. And when you look just within the coronavirus pandemics, we had people who did really well, fully infectious, like we all did the tests, right? We could all see that we were infectious, but some had massive symptoms, others didn't. And just because the differences in the population, it makes it really hard to say, well, there's a miracle here of healing, virus is there, there's no disease. It could also well be a difference in immune systems. So I think we really reach our limits there with the sciences. We just can't tell. But it also means we can't exclude it, which is also interesting, isn't it?
That's a really interesting question. And I think it speaks really well into the fact that you're doing virology and theology, the fact that actually the two together are really important. That's a great question. So what's your biggest conviction for thinking that God is good, and effectively how would you define good?
So I think my personal conviction is mainly built on seeing that Jesus was a historical person. He died on the cross. And if that's the willingness that God has to take our suffering upon him, I think in my worldview that is the best version of good I can think of. But I'm not sure if that's caused by my sociology, the way that I'm, you know, that I was raised in a Western culture, but I think that's such a high value to sacrifice my own good for someone else's good. And I think that's, if we assume that Jesus was God, which I do based on the biblical evidence that I have, I think that's probably on an intellectual level, that's how what I can cling to, even if I don't feel that and experience that, that God is good. Every now and then, yes, I think, oh, this was really nice of God. And sometimes you ask for things in prayer and you see them happening, and that's nice. But what do I do with the times where he doesn't respond? So I think personal experience, yes, I can always go back to events where I felt like he was really good to me, but it doesn't help me in a situation where I feel he doesn't. Whereas Jesus at the cross, that stands because that happened. And so I can always cling to that. So I think ultimately I would go back to the intellectual understanding. God took upon himself my suffering, and I think that's quite powerful. So that's a purely theological, without science reasoning.
If God does something that doesn't look like it's good, in inverted commas, whatever that means for you, that goes against your intuitions, would you still say that that's good? Or where do you get that reference point for good?
Yeah. I think that's important, and I think maybe the natural sciences helped me to put me back into that spot of humility to understand that where I am as a created human being, there's limited understanding of the world. And yes, I can study a lot and I can try to explore things, but ultimately I won't know because I'm not God. And I think when you study the natural sciences, you understand your limits, or at least I reach my limits, because we're constantly living with the limits of technology and the limits of knowledge. And I think if people are honest, this is both exciting, but also puts you in your place, and we should be humble about where we are with the things. And so I think the natural sciences are a reminder for me that although I have the Bible, there is limited knowledge we have from the Bible. The Bible has a lot of things it doesn't explain. And whenever I think God is doing something that I'm not convinced is great, maybe I don't understand what he's doing, but also, how am I sure that this is what God's doing? is this actually God's doing, or is it caused by something else? And I think these are two things that I won't ever fully know, and I have to trust at this point that Jesus at the cross in the very end is ultimately good. But yeah, you're right, the questions about the reference point probably remains to some extent.
How do we reconcile the passages that clearly speak about the wrath of God and perhaps some of those genocide passages where it looks like God is asking particular kings in the Old Testament to wipe out children, women, innocent people? Yeah. Rather you than me, Miriam.
Thank you. That's lovely. No, you're absolutely right. And I do understand that people are concerned about content in the Old Testament, but they probably also should be, you know, similarly concerned about content in the New Testament, but it's a shorter time frame, so we just have less of these incidents. And I think what helps me as a theologian is that when I look back in church history and I see the early church fathers not brushing over them and saying this is all fine and, you know, well, we can live with the wrath of God, it's all good. No, they were similarly outraged, they were similarly frustrated, they were similarly concerned about children being murdered, women being raped, and I think none of that is all right. And there's certain, like, half of these incidences is human beings making decisions, and sometimes you can see God putting it right, asking to take responsibility, like for example, David. David gets his judgment because he has not acted correctly and he has raped a woman most likely, and God deals with that. In other instances, he doesn't, and that's a reality that I'm frustrated with. And when I currently look at, you know, the wars we see in the world, the famine, all of these things, I wonder, why does God not act right now? Why does he not put justice to this right now? And I think it's a biblical reality that he doesn't interfere all the time, and I wouldn't understand ever why he doesn't, and it's frustrating. What you're talking about is the wrath of God as an active God asking people to murder a certain type of people, to take the Holy Land, for example, when the Israelites came out of Egypt. And I think this is really bizarre for us, and I'm not sure what to think about that. I think these passages are difficult, and they will always be difficult. And I think it's really hard, especially for some of them. Yes, we claim that's what God wanted. How about modern warfare to take up countries like in the Middle Ages, for example? Of course, most of them were politically dominated. This was not God's will. And there are these few in the Bible that I don't know how to deal with, I'm quite honest. And I think that's all I can say, because of course the natural sciences don't help with that. And I think they are difficult. And I hope, that's basically looking back from the cross, I hope that God will redeem these people because they have suffered. And I think that's not just. But assuming coming from the cross that God is a just God who's also holy, and I think that's a quality, as you said, that in the evangelical world we lack understanding of, because we come from this very friendly God loves me perspective, which is great, but we're losing this holiness. And I think we're not living in a culture where we're used to a moral right or wrong. We come from an age where there's no longer any truth. Your truth is as fine as my truth. And I think with God, we have to deal with a holy God where there is a truth, at least on moral grounds. And that's very different to the natural world, I think. But I don't understand that. And and then we come back to the, what's your reference point for good? I think God is setting the reference point for good. And I need to acknowledge that in many occasions, I don't understand that. And that I hope that one day he'll make it right.
As I say, you wrote a brilliant ABC Religion article about the connection between coronavirus and the climate crisis. What is the connection between a pandemic, a global pandemic, viruses and climate crisis, would you say?
Yeah, I think the main connection is that when you look at what makes a virus spread, you have the genetic factors within the virus or any other pathogen. You have the factors within your immune system, and we can't change much of both. we're basically trying to sequence and understand what happened to the virus. So we're always one step behind. With our immune system, yes, we can understand how immune systems work, and we can help with therapies to help us adjust with the virus infection. But what's also really affecting virus spread is, first of all, human behavior, from how do we build our cities, how do we treat animals, how do we plant plants to as food production chains go. Traveling, like overpopulation, all of these things. And then there's also all the environmental factors that change how viruses spread. And I think these two are the connection between viruses like the pandemic and climate change, because humidity, temperatures, rainfall, all of these things do change ecosystems. They change how certain animals behave, the groups they live in, the way they migrate. And with this comes a migration and a spread of virus. And also deforestation is a big issue apart from the climate change, because it forces animals closer into our habitats. It takes away their habitats. If we reduce diversity of animals, it might actually increase the likelihood of a virus adapting to the next host, instead of being able to, because it's spread around, to not have that specificity. So there are certain behavioral traits and environmental factors. And I think in that article, I mainly pointed out that if we don't look at after the environment well, and climate change is one of these issues, we will see increasing amount of viruses spreading into the human population, because we're destroying ecosystems, animals will migrate into ours. With arboviruses, so anything that's transmitted through mosquitoes and ticks, they of course move with the vector, with the mosquito or tick. And since we are becoming slightly warmer, the mosquitoes will be happier here. And liking mosquitoes now, thanks to my new job, that's intriguing, but of course they bring their diseases, and some of them will affect us. And I think these are things that we can influence, and we should look out for and make sure we do the best we can.
If you had, let's say, a minute, let's do this sort of classic elevator pitch. You're stood in the lift with one of your science colleagues who's not a Christian, has no reference point for God, and they ask you, why does God allow suffering? Mm-hmm. What would you say?
I would acknowledge that this is a difficult question, and that I can't ever know if the answer I give him is right. What I can tell him is that suffering in many ways is necessary, so it's also one mechanism that protects us. If I don't experience the hot plate, I'll just leave my hand on the oven and burn myself. But it also creates things, it keeps ecosystems in a balance. If one animal species would take over, the other ones would constantly be prey and die out. So it keeps diversity happening, and I think there's lots of beauty that evolved on this planet. There's lots of eco-theologians who say, well, there's a value in these things. I'm not sure if we have enough value from just that makes up for the suffering. But I do believe in a God who can redeem these things, and there's value in that. I don't understand why he allows it, but I'm pretty sure he will make up for that. And yeah, again, he hasn't taken himself out of this.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
That's a really interesting question. I guess there's two parts to that in some ways. You haven't said it, but I wonder if there's a second part of it, which I'll maybe say at the end, which is that, like, is there ever a time where we could stop mosquitoes spreading malaria if we could? I mean, we're talking about this over dinner. But the question that was asked is the flip side of that. Is there ever a duty as Christians to be able to release a positive virus that does good for society and humanity and other species, hopefully?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I really like that question, because I think with the natural sciences having now all the technology and so much knowledge, we're coming into these ethical debates, and the question, by not using it, is that actually less ethical than using them? And what do we mean when we say human flourishing? And then we come into a very interesting philosophical debate. What is quality of life? How important is health, like physical health versus mental health? And where do we need to focus on? And in the very end, we still die after, I don't know, 80, 90 years. So we can't stop death anyway. So what's worth achieving here, and what are we aiming for? I think in terms of the technological part of the question, if we would be able to design a virus that would be safe and would improve something, I think, yes, why wouldn't we use that? We use other things, like we know how to get a bone healed once it's broken, and we use the things that we have. And the virus is just so much a physical item as whatever we help the bone to get that reconstructed. And in parts, we're doing that. So we're using certain viruses for therapy against cancer, because these viruses are very specifically killing off cancer cells. And that's amazing. And of course, why wouldn't we want to use that? We use them sometimes to deliver gene therapy. So there are very few gene therapies approved in Europe, but some work really well, and they're delivered by a viral particle, and we make use of that. Or we're using viruses as vaccines, and they work beautifully, because it means that our immune system gets trained in whatever it might face next, and that's amazing. So we're doing that already, and I think for some applications, I think, yes, of course, I think God has given us the ability to do this. Let's do it. But I think we should also understand the limitation. We will still ever die. We can't hinder that. And I think human flourishing is more than just physical health. And I think we also shouldn't overestimate what we can do biologically.
I guess tied in with that question is also the question of how far is too far, and are we playing God with some of this sort of gene manipulation? Yes. So perhaps not viruses, but how would you respond to that question as a theologian?
Yeah.
And a virologist.
I think probably in a similar way. I think we need to understand why we're doing what we're doing and we're trying to achieve there. And if the goal is to play God and to massively impact something that we really shouldn't, I think we're basically in the wrong position, and the chance that this goes wrong because we won't achieve what we want is probably quite high. But I think if we use biological processes, and for all other sorts of therapies, we're doing that. We've studied nature, we're using the things we've seen, we're using them for good. Why wouldn't we do that with the genetics we're now starting to describe, and why wouldn't we use that with the viruses we're developing for good? But again, I think knowing our limits and understanding the bigger picture of what being human actually means is probably key here. And that's a very difficult discussion, and I'm glad that it's not just virologists and theologians, but there are also ethicists and philosophers, and I think that's a whole societal effort to keep the conversation going. And I think it's something that during the pandemic we've noticed we've fallen short of, because most people who don't work in sciences, A, didn't have a glimpse of an idea of how we're actually working, so we had all these trust issues when we tried to communicate, this is a pandemic, this is how it works, these are our options of how we can deal with it. And I think if we did better at keeping people in these conversations and making sure they understand, and you don't need to understand the details, but you need to understand the big picture, and I think we can communicate these things, and as scientists we need to do better at that. I think then I think we're coming to a point where, yes, people have different values, and sometimes they clash, and that's difficult, but in many cases we probably agree on certain things, like this is an easy thing to do, this is a safe thing to do, this is a logic thing to do, this is a loving thing to do. And other things we'll go like, this already doesn't make any sense on a biological level, this doesn't help the patient. And, you know, there are probably a lot of easy decisions that can be made, but I think we need to communicate about them. And
Brilliant. Thank you. That is a wonderful question. So if we think about climate crisis and the fact that species have become extinct, and we were to ask those species who was biased in those decisions, or you know, in that natural process, that would be humanity. And how would you respond to that question?
Yeah, sure. We should be sorry. but it's difficult, right? Because with many things in life, whatever we decide, we will impact someone. We have to get our food somewhere. We have to produce clothing somewhere. Someone is always exploited in most of these processes. And I find it really difficult, and you might feel the same, about making ethical decisions about all of the things I do in life. So I feel like it's really hard to live in a sustainable way. I hope we'll find better ways, but I wonder if there isn't always a way in which we are making use of the planet and what it has. So there's always someone suffering from us. And that's also probably not brilliant.
So is there a way then of alleviating suffering for the most amount of species, do you think, in the way that we live?
It's really difficult, because one of the things I question in one of my articles, it's a book chapter actually, about parasites, is parasitism actually worse than predator-prey relationships? And I don't know, because predator-prey relationships we just take as a given. So there's always one species eating another, because we need to get food somewhere, we are eating the next species. Is that actually worse or better than parasites? Because parasites are defined by being living off another animal, whatever, or plant, in, I think, units less than one, whereas predator-prey is more than one. So just logically, mathematically, I think probably predator-prey is worse than parasitism. But I mean, is it a number game? Is it the same? Is it, you know, for the individual affected, it probably doesn't matter if it's a parasite or a predator that kills you. Again, as on a community level, there might be a difference. So I think that's really difficult. I'm not sure. So alleviating suffering would mean we need to stop all the predator-prey relationships. But what are all these animals going to eat? We can't turn them into vegetarians, because then all of these animals that eat animals, their whole digestive systems, their skull, their bones, all of that would need to change. And that's probably a long evolutionary process to get everyone to commit to being vegetarians. And then what are plants? You know, they're also living things. Are they suffering? We don't know. So what is anyone ever going to eat? But it's a really cool question, and I think it's intriguing, and we should think about these things.
Yeah, that's a great question. So do you either have a hero or heroine scientist that you aspire to be, or someone that inspired you to take up science in the first place?
Because I have this non-academic background and I didn't know any scientists, I think I was probably inspired just by teachers who taught me interesting facts, and I could see some of their passion, and I think that was my first encounter. The other thing is I did an internship with a company, and it was really interesting because they helped me learn some techniques but also think outside the box, because of course in a school you don't get taught how things are currently applied. And they were for a long time my heroes, because that's the only people who I knew who did interesting science and helped me understand how it works. I think on the long run, while studying viruses, I think some of the people I'm really intrigued by are like these early pioneers like Robert Koch, who in a world where no one understood that infectious diseases, what they're caused by and what makes them worse, who had to really fight to make people do small changes just hygiene-wise, and say, you know, it's something, if you get better hygiene, this will actually solve the problem. Or like the ones that connected the dots of, so we have a plague here, and there's a weird watering channel that's, you know, providing sewage. So maybe if we stop that, the plague, and it did stop. So I think these are the early days of making these connections, and I'm really intrigued by these people, because I think we're so used to the common ways of thinking, and academia and publishing encourages us to go down the mainstream way because it's much easier than facing like opposition. But I think in the early days where people didn't know what to look out for, actually when it made click, I'm really impressed by these people who brought a massive change. I want to say 19th century is quite an interesting period with lots of cool people.
That's a great question. Have you noticed a shift in science in terms of people being more amenable to Christianity? I think as well it's worth noting that your particular area of science, there does seem to be less Christians in biology than, say, physics or other areas of science. But have you noticed a change?
I don't think I've noticed a change in biology as a field. And of course, I don't know other disciplines really well. Within biology, I don't think it has changed massively. What I have noticed, but that's probably the process of me getting older and all my colleagues getting older, I think the further along your career trajectory you are, the more realistic people get. So I think in the early 20s, people studying sciences with me were like, this is the truth and this will prove there is no God and you know, this is amazing. And let's give them 10 years to do science. And we've all noticed the limitations of the methods we are doing. And I think also by being older, we've seen more about life. And I think the bigger questions in life were not answered by the sciences. So I think lots of the colleagues are just more realistic, and that makes them more humble, and it makes them more approachable, and at least they understand that there is valid reason for me to believe. It doesn't mean that they have to believe, but it means they no longer... I don't think they've ever made fun of it seriously in a way that it was trying to ridicule my faith, but I think they have a better understanding of why it's actually a point and a valid point to do that. I think one thing I noticed while I was studying is that there were lots of young people same age as I, and we all were excited about science and we all wanted to learn more about nature. And there was quite a high dropout rate during the first half of my course. And it was mainly because not because people didn't manage the workload or people didn't understand what was going on and just intellectually didn't have the capacity. The main dropout was because people thought, or we all thought coming from school, the sciences are so amazing, they'll answer all our questions. But actually, when we studied, we noticed the limitations. And there was a lot of disappointment. And they went into different disciplines. They went into something that gave them more meaning because the sciences couldn't provide meaning. The sciences are exciting and interesting, but they couldn't provide meaning. And so I have people that went into medicine because that gave them the meaning of I'm caring for patients. And yes, of course, my science will at some point hopefully benefit people. But I don't see that, and having the immediate benefit of seeing it is something they lacked in the course, and I give that to them, and I think that is something that all surprised us when we came from school, that there's not necessarily meaning in doing these things, and that was really interesting to watch.
Einstein said, "Science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind." Do you think that science and religion can coexist?
No, I would agree with the sentence. I think there's lots of different opinions about how Christian was Einstein and, you know, these issues. Alistair McGrath has written a whole book about that, so you can always read up on that. But I think I like that statement because that's very much what I feel is true in life. There's so much that science can't answer where you need a different method and a different approach, and that is something theology can provide. And the Bible does talk a lot about things, and it uses metaphors and it explains things in the daily life that people experienced when they encountered God. But it's not a book about biology. So anything we read in the Bible is not a description about the processes in nature. It's an image, and it uses it to describe things and explain faith. And that's helpful because faith is such an abstract thing. So having the world around us that we can see is really helpful to give us images and examples. But it doesn't explain the biology. And I think that's how they complement each other. And I think, yeah, that's why I love both of them. And I think it's not a conflict, no.
Yeah. That is such a good question. Right, in a minute, that's why I'm laughing. Not because it's not a great question, but because the fact that, yeah, sure, do that in a minute. So, do we have an immaterial soul? And if it was possible through genetic modification to create a clone, would that clone also have a soul?
I think the interesting question would be, would that clone have the identical soul to my other clone, or would it be a different soul? I think this is fun in many ways as a question, because A, I think this distinction between body, soul, and spirit is very much a Greek concept, mm-hmm. I think, and who knows if that's actually the case. So there's a whole group of people trying to understand what makes a human being, and what actually is consciousness. We still don't understand how our thoughts form. I have no idea, and that's one of my biggest questions in life, how does faith form? Because it's this weird interplay between my own intellect, but then something else. I don't understand what a soul is in the first place, and as biologists, we also can't explain what a personality is made of. You've all seen how like tiny babies already have a personality, yet of course they haven't learned a lot, and you know there's still synapses forming, but there's a whole personality, and you won't very much change that. I've seen babies grow up into adults, same personality. Yes, they learn things, but you know there's certain intriguing features that just are who they are. So I would say there is something that's not just physically measurable, that makes up a person. I can't tell you what it is, and I don't understand it, and I think it's fascinating. And I think people who encounter or like watch the process of someone dying, they say that the moment they died, it's a very different encounter with the dead body. It no longer feels like that person, so there's something different. There's a different quality or feature to that person suddenly. And I would probably agree with that, but I really don't know what it is. And in terms of cloning, I think there's a lot to cloning, and we're probably still far off of getting it right. But there's a lot of packaging of DNA, so it's not just having the correct genes and the correct orientation, it's also the accessibility and certain biochemical processes that and rhythms of things. So it's quite complex. But given that, I assume there's probably something that's immaterial that, I don't know if you call it soul or something that makes a person, I don't think you would probably be able to clone that, but that's just my opinion, so who knows. But yeah, I would assume biology you can probably mimic, but there's a lot that comes with it as a person that probably is determined by other factors. I think twin studies are really fun, actually, because if you have identical twins, same genetics, but it's very different personalities, and some of it is forced by the environment and featured by the environment, and other seems to be intrinsic and no one knows where it comes from. So
I'm a twin. I can
concur. You can relate.
Yeah,
okay.
We're totally different. Gosh, what a good question to end on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for all your questions. They've been absolutely fantastic.
They have been brilliant.
Miriam, thank you so much. You have been absolutely outstanding. Do Google her. She's got loads of great stuff online that you can read for free. Some of it is quite heavy work, but it's totally worth it. But you've also written at a slightly more popular level as well, and we are just so grateful for you, Miriam. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.